Thank you very much. I'm Ann Kenny, the proud Carl A. Kroc University librarian, and I'm honored to introduce Anthony Marks, the president and CEO of New York Public Library. Dr. Marks began his tenure at NYPL in July of 2011. During his first 450 days, he's brought about a lot of change. He's also attracted a lot of media attention. I wasn't surprised that the New York Times recently ran a lengthy profile about him, but what did surprise me was that it was on the front page of the style section. There are not many library folks who can claim that. I met Tony perhaps within the first month of your being at NYPL. What was supposed to be a brief introduction resulted in an hour's stimulating discussion about the future of libraries, and we've continued that discussion online and in person since then. His ideas about the mission of NYPL are bold and stimulating. Whether it's contemplating the role, whether it's contemplating the role of libraries at the intersection of author and reader, reimagining the future of the iconic 42nd Street building, expanding services to researchers and local communities, collaborating with the New York City school system, or cutting deals with publishers. I can't think of anyone more visionary and more provocative to take on the question of whether we still need a library. Dr. Marks didn't start out with the idea that someday he'd lead one of the world's greatest libraries. A native New Yorker, he attended PS 98 and the Bronx High School of Science, went on to attend Wesleyan and Yale. He received his MPA, MA, and PhD degrees from Princeton. In the 1980s, he helped found Kenyon College, a South African secondary school that prepared more than 1,000 black students for university. And then he returned to his native New York to become a professor and director of undergraduate studies of political science at Columbia University. Something Tony just told me recently, although he is a highly regarded scholar and has received so many awards and fellowships, he has never served as a department chair or a dean or has held any other higher education post when in 2003 Amherst tapped him wisely to serve at its 18th president, a position now held by Biddy Martin. Dr. Marks served as Amherst president until 2011, when he became the president of NYPL. Sounds like a pretty reasonable trajectory to me. Looking at Tony Marks' career from a distance, a clear theme emerges. He's passionate about promoting accessibility, stimulating thought, creating inspiring spaces for people to work together. This embodies that idea of community within a library, whether it's at one of the world's greatest universities or one of the world's greatest cities. So please join me in welcoming Tony Marks.
Well, thank you, Ann. As Ann said, I very quickly recognized Cornell has a great librarian in having Ann, and I've been using her advice since I arrived and continue to be grateful for that and for her leadership here at Cornell. I also want to thank David for inviting me to be here today. If you think back 150 years, one of the things that's amazing is to imagine the moment Abraham Lincoln, the most violent domestic conflict in American history, and here's a president who has the foresight in the middle of that horrible conflict to invest in the future, to invest in a future with the Morrill Act and the construction that would also lead to Cornell University that is under David's amazing leadership. And I say that as a fellow college president of one time. an industry that, shall we say, has a slightly conservative bent. You have an amazing leader who is thinking of how to even further maximize the amazing strengths of this institution, which is, in higher education, the great example of public and private partnership and of leadership in the world. So, David, it's an honor to be here with you. All right, I got my glasses on so we can talk libraries. So I'm sure you all thought that the question that I posed as the title of the talk was a fake. It wasn't. When a couple years ago I told my 16-year-old, I remember the scene, in the mansion of the president at Amherst College, where he'd been very comfortably ensconced for 8 years, that we'd be moving and going to New York, where I would take on the leadership of the New York Public Library, he looked at me and, without actually missing a beat, said, "Dad, you didn't get the memo that libraries are going out of business?" It gets worse. He went back and sulked for an hour, came back and said, "Okay, Dad, I've been thinking about it. I think you found the only institution I can think of in the world that has zero revenue." Welcome to my world. So I disagree with my son. I suspect we all disagree with my son. Even my son now disagrees. Let us think about what libraries are about. They are about the sharing and development of ideas. They are the seed corn for the development and sharing of ideas. In that sense, they share the core mission with great universities and colleges, because Cornell is also committed to the development and the production and sharing of ideas. And Cornell's library is front and center in that. In fact, as a great university library that is open to the public here in Ithaca, that is also a great partnership. The New York Public Library particularly embraces this combination because it is uniquely both a great research library and a great circulating library. We are, and by the old count of how many books we had, that used to be the sort of U.S. News and World Report version for libraries, not so much anymore. We are the most used research library in the world, and certainly the most democratically accessible. And we are the largest circulating library in America. Together, I think that makes us the greatest library in the world. Great because we are seeking to find the strengths of combining the sort of what has been described as the elitist vision of research production and the sort of much more sort of mass-based level of circulation and access to information. And that is so New York, it's so Cornell as well, and it is such an amazing challenge in the 21st century. And we are meeting that challenge. Last year, something like 20 million physical visits to the New York Public Library in 1 year, more than all of the cultural institutions and sporting teams in New York combined, and that's even the case in years when the Yankees are doing well. I grew up a Mets fan, I can do that. Wow, that's never happened before. Surely the notion of production and sharing of ideas is not going out of business, but is all the more important since we live now in the information age. And in fact, I would argue there is nothing more essential to the future of the economy, because we need skilled workers. Andrew Carnegie understood that when he created the circulating libraries of New York with the single largest philanthropic gift ever in history. And I had occasion to remind Bill Gates of that record, not yet having been beaten. And it is also essential for a functioning democracy. I don't care what your politics are, but as a Democrat, you must believe that informed voters are essential if we're going to have a democracy that works. And the library is the basis of that. In New York City, something like a third of the citizens depend on the public libraries to be able to read because they can't afford books. We worry about economic divide in this country. Imagine what our society would look like if, in addition, we had not just a digital divide, but an access to reading and books divide. But of course, we are at a moment of great change. This is the Gutenberg moment for libraries. We haven't seen a change like this in 500 years. And I think it's important that we see that libraries were never about books per se, they were about production and access to ideas. Books have been the wonderful format for that. But the format is changing. I don't think books are going away, but the format is changing. And that is not a threat. It is an unbelievable opportunity. It's an opportunity for libraries, and it's an opportunity, as David was describing, for universities and for all players in the world of education. We need to invest, and we need to make smart decisions. But we know where we're headed. It's actually quite amazing. We are headed rapidly to a moment when everyone will carry something like this in their pocket, and on this sort of device, you will have many times the size of the Library of Alexandria at your personal disposal. It is amazing. Who could have imagined that we would get to that place? Now, of course, you, like I, probably worry about people reading on this device. I will tell you, I was riding to work on the subway the other day and leaned over and saw somebody reading a book on their smartphone. And I leaned over and I said, surely that is bad for your eyes. She sort of, you know, in New York fashion, looked up, looked over, looked at me, looked at the newspaper I was reading in very old-fashioned version, and said, my font is bigger than your font. Welcome to the 21st century. All right, so we need libraries, but we need to know what they do, what should they do, and what are the challenges for how to get there. So let me run through that as fast as I can. First, libraries are places, beautiful places, inspiring places. They are places where people come together across all differences. In New York, there is no place else where people come across the differences of diversity that Bob and David and everyone were talking about. In New York, it's the library where we come together. And we come together for thinking. Imagine that in the 21st century. People come because they need quiet, because they need computers. 25% of New York doesn't have a computer at home. And they just want to be together because we're not cavemen. Even if we can read on devices at home, we want to be with other people. And so people come to read and they come to write. And those who come to read, we hope, will aspire to write, because we know that that's how thinking works. And that's true not just for adults, it's true for kids. It's true on college campuses. I read last night in, the latest alumni magazine that Cornell's library had 4.5 million physical visits last year. That is amazing. At Amherst, I would see the kids streaming into the library, even if they didn't have to come for the books. Nationally, a study came out yesterday that said 60% of those who are 16 to 29 years old use the library physically on a regular basis. That is not going to stop. But of course, the collections have been what people have generally identified with the library. And they come in a variety of kinds. So let's march through a few of those. First, there are the unique collections, the rare books, the archives. The New York Public Library, like Cornell, has some amazing, amazing ones. I'd been on the job for a few months. My son, same son, comes in, says, "Dad, I think you should come with me." I said, "What?" He said, "I want to show you an exhibit." Somehow no one had mentioned to me that we had an exhibit. I went down and we looked around, and there was, for instance, the only copy in the world of the letter that Christopher Columbus sent to King Ferdinand to say, "I think I may have found something." And actually, when I then read the letter, in 4 pages, it summarizes the beginnings of colonialism in a way that I have never seen done before. That unique letter was a teaching tool, the likes of which I had never seen. And I've been teaching the development of world economic systems for a long time. So I asked what else we had. Turns out the New York Public Library, amongst its 55 million holdings, has one of the 14 original copies of the Bill of Rights. George Washington had them drawn up, sent around to 13 states seeking ratification. The embarrassing news is this particular copy hasn't been seen in public in 40 years. It's been kept very safe in a safe. I am looking for $1 million, which is what it will cost, to create an absolutely safe box, the most expensive box I've ever heard of, so that we can put our Bill of Rights out on public display. Why do I think that's so important? Well, it is the founding document of the United States, and I actually still believe in the Bill of Rights. Even on my rough days with the New York Times, I still believe in the Bill of Rights. But when I asked to see the document, they showed it to me. That's a thrill. And I looked at it, and I read it, and I said, "Well, this is lovely, but you've been had." They looked at me very concerned. I said, "Well, I don't know much, but I'm pretty sure there are 10 amendments in the Bill of Rights. There are 12 in this document. It's a fake." "No, it's not." It turns out Washington and the Congress sent 12 amendments around for ratification and only succeeded at getting 10 ratified. And, even more amazing, they picked the right 2 to get rid of. If they had kept the other 2, we'd have a Congress of more than 5,000 members now. We know that that would work out oh so well. And the last one stipulated how much to pay Congress, as if that it was an issue on the level of the fundamental rights. Only by seeing a unique historical document like that do you learn what democracy really means, that it's founding, and that actually democracy works. So we have to preserve those collections, and we have to make them available. Next is my personal favorite, academic journals. So this is really crazy stuff. Here's how the system works. Academics get paid by universities. They get money from the federal and state governments. They do all the work. They review each other's work in order to get it published in a journal, I don't know whether I'm about to make any enemies in the room, by a company that then charges through the roof to sell it back to the university. I actually once had someone who was in this business describe to me when he first heard this model, he said, "Oh my God, this is a license to print money." And indeed, it was for him. That's great for him. Not so good for access to those journals. In fact, I just asked Anne before this talk, Cornell spends close to $20 million or $10 million a year on subscriptions to academic journals. So if we could find a different solution, David, that would be worth about $200 million of endowment to you. So let me suggest the following. Here, if ever there was an opportunity for collective action, this one is just sitting there waiting. Why can't the great universities of the land get together with their faculty and say, let's do our own journals. We're doing the writing. We're doing the reviewing. We can now publish them electronically. We don't have to charge anybody, and we certainly don't have to gouge universities for it. There can be no question about quality in that outcome. And it will have two additional great effects. One, the public at large now has no access to academic journals. When there is cutting-edge research on a disease from Weill Cornell faculty or anyone else, and your relative has that disease, you can't read the cutting-edge research if you're not a part of a university. Can't be done except at ridiculous prices. That's a problem that we need to solve. Similarly, the system now, in effect, creates an inside circle where only academics are reading academic journals. So here's a sentence I could never have said as a college president, and since Bob said I should be provocative, I'm giving it my best shot here. If academics only read each other's stuff, we create an incentive for academics to get narrower and narrower and more self-referential. If suddenly academic production was available to the world, there would be a counter pressure for academic production to be more open to large ideas and more accessible to the rest of the world that might want to read. So, some low-hanging fruit there. Good luck, David. I tried this out on Drew a couple weeks ago. Let's turn to books. So we have sort of competing interests here. There are the rights of authors. Authors should be paid. I wrote 3 books. I never made much money. That's okay. It wasn't why I was doing it. They didn't sell very much. But we want people to be able to be paid to write books, if for no other reason, well, certainly it seems fair, and also it's how we create an incentive to continue to produce more books. That's why we need publishers, who also ensure the quality of what we have in front of us. But revenue is protected by copyright, which lasts for a lifetime plus 70 years. So in most institutions, the assumption is things are protected for about 150 years to be safe. That seems excessive. In fact, to be honest, our copyright laws are driven by lobbying to Congress headed by Disney. Because Disney has a real interest, I understand it, in protecting their creative production. But it is, sorry about this, Mickey Mouse, to have the corpus of the world's information and access to it driven by public policy determined by Disney's needs. Let's meet Disney's needs, but they're not the same as the world's needs of access to ideas. Because readers have rights too. And by that I mean the public at large to the most expert. Everyone who's using the New York Public Library or their Cornell University libraries. It's easy to sort of divide this somewhat falsely into 2 kinds of books. So let's start with academic books. Again, we have, academics are so good at this, we've created a truly crazy model. We have great university presses that are producing too many books at too high a cost and too little access for everyone to get to them. Now books are selling maybe 300 copies is a standard run for what you can assume an academic book will sell to libraries in the world. It used to be 3,000. We need a different system. We need university presses to ensure the quality of what is produced because we rely on that for tenure decisions, and also because, as a political scientist, I didn't want to read 1,000 different versions of X theory. I want some help to figure out what are the best things to read. So you need some quality controls. But we no longer need to assume that that means everything needs to be printed. Books of small run can be printed on demand more cheaply, and you'll have increased availability. We need to ensure that university presses or their successors have revenue. And generally, the way that the revenue is produced for academic material is through course books, things that sell all the time. That's sort of the bestsellers version for academic books. Also, a slightly crazy model, and I say that painfully because I just spent $1,000 on my son's first semester college textbooks. That's a problem, particularly because not everyone can easily afford an extra $1,000 for their college textbooks. And lastly, the academic publishing raises the question of, if we don't solve to a better model, in effect, we may be helping to bring about the end of what's described as the long form of publication. The book, as a method of delivery, made particular sense in terms of the history of physical production and publishing. That's gone, or going away. If we don't figure out ways to subsidize long-form production, we will only be producing things in snippets. You can do quality in snippets, but you can also do crap in snippets. And I believe there is some value in long-form where we read things we weren't looking for rather than just going to what we've been directed. So we have some work to do on the academic side. I do think there are some interesting proposals out there for, in effect, buying cooperative arrangements where we give university presses enough money to keep them going, ensure revenue, but also ensure access to libraries at much cheaper costs. And I think we're all going to have to be exploring those. But let's turn to slightly more popular books. And we don't have to talk about Jacqueline Suzanne. We can talk about the majority of books that people come to the library, including the university library, to read. And how do we ensure access to those on these devices? Well, Google, which I'm delighted to hear is working with Cornell on the project in Roosevelt Island, which I hope the New York Public Library can also be of service on, has a fair more resources than I have at the New York Public Library. And they have not been able to solve the puzzle of how to make available all the world's books online. They spent millions and millions of dollars to scan millions and millions of books, and the court said, sit on it. And that's where it's currently sitting. And bookstores, of course, are closing. And even when they weren't closing, they would keep a book on shelf for a very limited period of time, because that's when the money is made on most certainly bestsellers. So we need to be adjusting to the fact that books, bestsellers will sell large numbers of copies in 3 months or 6 months, and then often much less. And some books never sell much, but we need to have them available. And some books don't sell much, and then suddenly they're discovered somewhere out in the long tail, and they explode in sales. The technology we currently have is perfect for meeting these shifting demands rather than the rather sticky proposition of the physical book. So, how do we solve the problem? And let me be clear about what the problem is. When I got to the New York Public Library, I was told that 4 of the big 6 publishers who produce 72% of the books in the world refused to sell e-books to libraries because they, understandably, were scared that if it's too easy to borrow a book for free from the library, they would go out of business. That meant that we were facing a future in which a technology that wants access to be more readily available was going to collapse the access that Andrew Carnegie and the public libraries had ensured for a century. There is the Digital Public Library of America plan, based with Bob Darton and his colleagues at Harvard, Anne and others working on, and we hope that they will succeed where Google has failed. But the New York Public Library isn't going to sit idly by in the meantime, partly because we sit in the city that is the center of the information age and happens to be the headquarters of the publishing industry. So what we've said to the publishers is pretty straightforward. We are not purists. Being a purist and saying, give me all your books for free so that I can lend them to everyone for free is not going to work. They have the copyrights. It's just not going to work. So instead, what I've said is, let's make a deal. In fact, we have, oddly enough, a common interest. Obviously, we have a common interest in promoting books, which the library does too. And if people want to buy books rather than wait to get them from the library, that's fine by us. But our common interest is, if you will allow me the phrase, a means-tested interest, which is we have to make sure that that bottom third of society that won't or can't afford books has access to them while still protecting the revenue from the other two-thirds that subsidizes the production of books. And publishers, they would like that bottom third to read too and to sell to libraries because they're not going to get any revenue otherwise out of that bottom third. So the trick is how to find a solution. We move Penguin from the no category into the yes category simply by saying, we'll wait for 6 months for your bestsellers. Go make your money. Give us the 90% in the backlist. Because in the end, the library's responsibility is not to ensure that everyone can read Jacqueline Suzanne for free. The library's chief duty is to make sure that the corpus of the world's books are available to everyone at any time. We have to be creative about this. I'll take just one minute aside to tell you about trying to be creative. We all grew up in a system of public school libraries that is now out of date. 10,000 often out-of-date books and a card catalog cannot meet the needs of kids in the 21st century. 2 weeks ago, the mayor of New York announced, that the New York Public Library, partnering with Queens and Brooklyn, would become the circulating library for the entire public school system. What that means is every school library will have computers connected not to 10,000 books in the room, which will still be there, but to 17 million circulating books. And we will deliver whatever any teacher or student needs. Suddenly, the world of books is available to students. And we know from having done this in 84 schools over the last year that kids will read 3 times as many books. And they'll do better at school, which is what we're after. So the last issue. It isn't just about places and material. It's about quality and curation. What do I mean by that? We always went to the reference librarian as the person we could trust. When we were looking something up and we went to the card catalog and there were 100 books, it was the reference librarian we went to and we said, what do I read? And he, often she, would say, honey, these two, skip these other 98. We need that more now than ever. Imagine when the day comes that all of the world's books are available to all of us electronically. We will need help sorting quality from crap more than ever. And somehow, the libraries of the world, because we're unbiased, because we're trusted, because we're expert, have to provide that service. So what is the vision? At the New York Public Library, it will still be physical libraries. It will still be the branches and the Central Library plan, including, thanks to a generous donation from your own Abby and Howard Milstein, we will keep all of the books at 42nd Street and 5th Avenue right there in better preserved storage. That was, some of you may have read, a controversy that happily the Milsteins enabled us to solve. We will also use our branches to project more educational programs, because libraries are educators. We are not simply repositories, we are educators. And we will solve the virtual puzzle, both in terms of access and in terms of curation. And when we're done with that, we will have a library that we can then think about projecting into the world, collaborating with Cornell and other institutions, because once those puzzles are solved, once there is the world's corpus of books here, then why should that be true only for the people of New York or the people of Ithaca? Why shouldn't it be true for the people of Ghana and South Africa, who cannot afford physical libraries, certainly if we cannot afford them at the same level? We're all going to need to cooperate together. Things are going to change, but let's remember our history. In the United States, it is higher education and libraries that are our best, most powerful global leader. That's why the world comes to us. It's why the world comes to Cornell. It's why they look to us. Our democracy, our economic innovation rests on those services. And libraries and universities were founded together. America's first university, founded by a gift of a library. This university, President White brought with him his library because he understood how central that was. My personal favorite story is the Amherst story, when President Zephaniah Moore decided that Williams couldn't possibly be a going concern because it was in the middle of nowhere. That was a line that used to work better when I had an Amherst audience. And was recruited to become the first president of Amherst. He loaded up his horse with 7 books. I know this because the president of Williams says the accumulated fines on those 7 books is roughly the same as the Amherst endowment, just by coincidence. But it tells you something. It tells you something that he knew heading out to this new venture, that what he needed as literal seed corn was the library, or the beginnings of the library. Today, in the 21st century, when we wander out into the wilderness of change and a new world, we need, Cornell needs, New York needs, our saddlebags with the library, in whether it's books or whether it's gizmos, because that will always be the seed corn of what we aspire from these institutions and what these institutions aspire to provide to the world. Let me stop there and ask you for your questions. Please. Yes, sir.
So
I assume if you can tell anything about me, you can tell I'm open to pretty much all possibilities. So what I said to the publishers is, I'm happy to make whatever deal works. And in fact, I like the idea of making different deals with different publishers for two reasons. One, I really don't want a visit from the Department of Justice. In fact, the publishers don't want more visits from the Department of Justice. And second, if we try different models, we'll be running a social science experiment that we can then assess and see how it works. They can also see how it works, right? They're looking to test models to see whether I'm right that selling books to libraries to lend will not reduce their revenue, and in fact, because of promotion and word of mouth, may increase their revenue, right? So we're all looking for a social science test which does suggest we should be open to all kinds of possibilities. And one of the ones that we're talking, so we started with four of the big six saying no. We're now 3-3. I was with one yesterday. I think before the end of the calendar year, I'm gonna have all six selling electronic books to libraries for the first time, and there'll be different models. And I bet amongst those models will be a metering system, which is, instead of a one-time cost as if it was a physical book, a metered use, right? So we pay for uses with some cap, because we can't subsidize everyone who wants to read Jacqueline Suzanne. We simply can't afford it, right? And my guess is, not only do I think that's a good idea and certainly worth exploring, the alternative model, which was based on the book, which was the library pays a lot of money up front for in perpetuity rights to a physical object, now a virtual object, that model doesn't make any sense in the virtual world, because the format of delivery and the systems or negotiations of that delivery are changing so fast that it's crazy for me to spend money on a perpetual arrangement when 2 years from now there's going to be a whole different arrangement I can't even imagine. So metering is certainly one of the ones we're exploring and negotiating around. Sir.
First of all, thanks for sharing with us your vision. While you were talking about the collections, enumerating the ones you've got, it occurred to me a little bit that you were also interested in collaboration. So it's not so much about the collections of books. It's what are some specific ways in which you see your library, libraries globally, helping scholars, businessmen, students collaborate on different kinds of projects?
So I'll come at that in two different ways. One, there is libraries themselves collaborating. So we have collaboration systems, for instance, with Columbia and NYU in terms of books moving on the island of Manhattan. We collaborate with Princeton and Columbia in terms of offsite storage, just as you're collaborating with Columbia and others. There's no alternative there. I mean, for three different institutions to buy a book that some one person might look at 20 years from now, instead of three institutions buying that book, is just very hard to justify in this particular economic moment, right? And my guess is we need to find other ways to collaborate as well, which is, for instance, we have millions of archival unique items. So do you, so does Harvard, so does the Library of Congress. At some point, we want to digitize more of those. We're trying, right? Very expensive. My guess is we'll probably never digitize all of them. There'll be some that are so sufficiently arcane that it will make more sense. You know, the one scholar who wants to look at it's going to really want to see the physical version anyway. And it's our job to preserve that physical version and have it available to him or her. But there'll be millions of items that should be scanned so that if people can't come to New York or Ithaca, they're somewhere else in the country, somewhere else in the world, they can have access to it. And there, we're going to need a better form of collaboration than we now have to divvy up the responsibility and the costs of doing that, right? Everyone's going to be worried about free riders. Everyone's going to say, let them scan that, or let Harvard scan that. They have more money, or whatever, right? We're going to need to find a system to get beyond that, to get this project done, right? As for the more general issue of collaboration, and Anne can speak to this better than I can, I'm sure, you know, kids are coming to the library now they may not even come for the books, right? They're coming to be inspired and to be together, etc., but they're also coming for collaborative spaces because more and more of what happens here happens collaboratively, right? Think about what David was talking about, the notion that we may end up watching lectures on screen, but then physically coming together for the seminar, for the section, if that's what you call it at Cornell, for the discussion, right? Libraries are front and center in that. At the New York Public Library, we're going to renovate the main building, as I suggested, for the first time in 100 years in a very dramatic way. We'll be bringing a circulating library back into a building that has only been a research library. So we're bringing the two pieces of the library back together in its central building. It's going to be amazing, right? Basically, you take the books out of stacks and put them in better preservation underground, thanks to the Milsteins. Now you can use the above ground space, 42nd Street and Fifth Avenue, pretty nice space, overlooking Bryant Park for a beautiful new circulating library designed by Norman Foster. It's going to be amazing. Stay tuned. We'll be showing some visuals in a couple weeks. When we design that library, which will have three times as much foot traffic, be open till 11 o'clock at night, and just be bursting with intellectual life, front and center is how do we create rooms for collaboration so that people who have no place else to go to meet with each other, to do the life of the mind together, we'll have a place to do that. And how do we make sure that that works even at the center, the cross streets of New York, or if you're a New Yorker, the world? Sorry. Yes, sir.
What kind of
So I'm trying. you can tell I run arguably the largest library in the world at the moment of the greatest transformation it's ever seen, right? So we've got to be open to all kinds of possibilities. I'll be honest, one of the things I love about my job, I get to be entrepreneurial in a way that scale of established institution, isn't always, right? One of the first things I did is I went to Google and I said, look, you've got 20 million books scanned. You can't do anything with them, partly because you're a private company. The court's scared of you having a monopoly. I think I can help you. I'm still waiting for an answer. I probably shouldn't be this honest. Similarly, we talked with Amazon. So Amazon is complicated, right? Because the publishers and Amazon, well, let's just say there's not a whole lot of love lost there. And I need the publishers right now because, as Willie Sutton said about the money in the banks, that's where the money is, meaning that's where the copyrighted corpus of the world's books are. And I need them to see me as a friend and promoter of books and even seller of books. I'm not adverse to come on the library site, see if the book can be borrowed, and if it can't and you don't want to wait, click here and you can buy it. I'm open to those kinds of possibilities. Exactly. So we haven't really figured out what to do with Amazon, though. We've been having some interesting conversations. They have, for instance, it's not officially Amazon, but they have a colleague, one of the founders of Amazon, who's now basically giving Kindles away out in the world, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, where they can't afford books, let alone fully developed libraries. And we're talking with them, for instance, about, one day we want to fill that Kindle in Ghana with the world's books, and that's part of what we're after. I mean, so there'll be interesting partnerships, but I'd say there's a little bit of careful sort of dancing around each other to start with, which, makes some sense. Last question, anybody else coming at me? Yes, ma'am.
Could you just describe a little bit about the
nature of the access that you're giving to New York City public schools in the circulating library concept that you have? Are they, for a lot of those kids who don't have their own computers, is it only in the classroom? Are they taking home?
Right.
What are they doing?
So the scheme, the plan, people tell me I'm not supposed to use the word scheme. The plan right now is pretty straightforward, right? So it'll take us 2 years to sort of get it to all 1,700 schools in the city. But every school library will have computers, our computers, linked to our collection, or ours and Brooklyn and Queens, hence the 17 million books. And, you know, they don't need a computer at home. During the school day, they're working on their research project on the Louisiana Purchase, the Morrow Land Act. Let's do that one. And, you know, you can't possibly expect there to be a good book on the Morrow Land Act or, you know, all the books you could want in the 10,000 books in the room. But of those 17 million books, not only will there be all the great books, but we'll buy more books because we know they're working on projects on the Morrow Land Act. And then we will physically deliver it to them at school. Maybe one day we'll say, you know, there's a branch library 2 blocks away. Why don't you go pick it up there? For the moment, we're going to deliver at school. So in that sense, it's a very straightforward model, which on the one hand is only possible because of modern technology, right? So thanks to Citibank, we could buy software that married 3 public library systems and the largest school system in the country's circulating collection and catalog so that they could talk to each other so we could move the books around. In that sense, it's a very modern notion. At the same time, it's a sort of no-brainer, right? Of course, you want to take the efficiencies of a massive system and apply it across 1.1 million kids, right? And the beauty of it is it only works because we're not France, right? It only works because everyone isn't doing the paper on the Morrow Land Act this Wednesday at 3, right? We don't have that kind of a national curriculum. So you can move things around. But what's interesting to me about it is I think the real reason why it didn't happen before was 100 years of bureaucratic wall building between 3 independent public library systems and the school system that had never actually broken those walls down. And basically, it wasn't that hard to just say, look, let's take the walls down. Oh, and by the way, I'll find the resources to pay for it, right? It's funny how that actually brings walls down, you know. But you can imagine 5 years from now, 10 years from now, when kids are reading books on their devices, right? And you're right, the poorest quarter of kids in New York don't have a computer at home, but actually the penetration of smartphones is amazing, right? And who knows what the net, my guess is, so if this happens, I want to cut. My guess is what's going to happen next is we're going to have iPads that fold and go in your pocket, but open to full tablet-sized screens, right? I mean, who knows what will happen next? The Kindle is $79 now. You know, if I was Amazon, I'd be giving it away, right? It's the razors and razor blades argument, right? And maybe that's what they will do, right? But you can imagine 5 or 10 years from now, the same system we have just created will become the system for virtual access to the collections that we are negotiating with publishers so that the kids have access to that. What's beautiful about this is it also means 1.1 million kids are going to use the library every day as part of school, and they will be our future. And that opens all kinds of other possibilities. I'll leave you with just this last thought. So the branch libraries, every day, 30,000 to 40,000 kids come into the New York Public Library branch libraries after school because it's safe, basically. Because, you know, their parents say, go to the library, you know, till 6 when I can get home, right? And that's amazing. And the kids do what my kids do when they're unsupervised, right? a little bit of homework and a lot of computer games. Right? I used to joke that in middle school, my son must have killed easily a million virtual people. You could hear them screaming from the other room. Even in the big house in Everest, you could hear them screaming. So it seems to me, and now that we have this partnership with the schools, it's going to be that much easier, we should be the largest after-school program in the country, right? We got the kids, right? We got the facilities. We got the trust and the brand name. God knows New York needs help to boost the achievement levels of education. We all know that more time on task is a pretty good starting way to do that. So, what's missing? Two things are missing. One thing that's missing is money. So you can tell I'm very much trying to think about what more this institution should do. 2 weeks ago, I got a letter from the mayor cutting the library's budget by another $7 million in mid-year. That means the New York City contribution to our budget will have gone down 22% in 5 years, and that's half our budget, right? So I'm going to need to find another way to do this. And the other thing that's in the way is we need to think about what the best way to do extended day after school is, right? I mean, again, technology makes all kinds of things possible that weren't possible before. How about instead of coming in to play computer games, how about you come in and we teach you how to build your own computer game? Wouldn't that be cool? Right? So we're trying to be creative about that. And then we'll find the resources, because I think David believes, when you have a great institution doing great things, particularly in the world of education, it's about the visioning. And then the resources, I'm not suggesting it's easy, but the resources come, right? Because we all care deeply about the future for our kids and our society. That's why you're all investing in Cornell, right? It's why I hope New Yorkers will invest more in the library. It's in the end, let's just be real clear about this. We're at a moment in history when, as a country, we are reducing our investment in our future, right? I mean, the public universities of America, are getting whacked, right? The community colleges, the school systems, the libraries, we're disinvesting in our future. Because we know, you all know, or you wouldn't be sitting here today, that the crucial investment is in education, in access to ideas and how to use those ideas and how to develop those ideas. We are at a moment in history where we have to, as a society, be creative, but also be strong with ourselves about doing what America, what Cornell has always done, which is we will invest in that future because there is no other way. It's an honor to be with you. Thank you for all you do for Cornell.